On behalf of the Newhall Family Theater and Mark II Entertainment, welcome to the extended interview of Talking Backstage. Today's guest is someone I've looked up to for a long time, Mr. Dan Gilbert. Before the stay-at-home orders in response to the COVID-19 pandemic, Dan was working as a special effects makeup artist in film and television. As a special effects makeup artist, Dan is responsible for creating characters, creatures, and monsters through the use of various makeup techniques. In this episode, Dan shares with us some stories of his time as a student in the Newhall School District, how he became a makeup artist, as well as the makeup product he created for application use. So Dan, welcome to Talking Backstage. Thanks for taking time out to talk with us.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. So first question, nice and easy. What schools did you attend while you lived in Santa Clarita?
Well, let's see. I moved to Santa Clarita, I believe I was 3 years old. So I attended Town and Country Farm School for preschool.
Wow.
I attended Old Orchard Elementary School.
Fantastic.
Graduated just with honors, sixth grade there. Then I went to Placer Rita Junior High School. And then I went to Hart High School, graduated in 99. And then I went to College of the Canyons and what was then called the Radio Television Film Program. And I ended up working there for several years afterwards in the equipment cage.
Oh, very cool. So the Newhall School District kind of prides itself on how much art opportunities we have for students. So what was the arts like for you when you were in elementary school?
Elementary school actually was a surprisingly strong time for art for me. We had an art teacher at Old Orchard named Miss Novi, and I became friends with her son, Brian, who's Dr. Novi now. He's a dentist.
Wow.
And he was one of my bosses. Later on in life, I worked at Six Flags Magic Mountain, and he was a supervisor there, manager. Mrs. Novi was really serious about art, and it was third grade, I believe, or second grade. And she took art very seriously for elementary school. She showed us probably artists that we wouldn't have had a chance to see. The art projects we did were strong. She was so passionate about it. And my dad was a sculptor for fun. And he was actually a really, really talented sculptor. And she just became enthralled with his work and had him come in and show work. I think when my sister was taking his class or her class.
Oh, very cool.
Sorry. Yeah, it was a great art program in elementary school. Strangely good.
Cool. So did you continue on with like art like after elementary school through junior high, high school, or?
I always dabbled. I like to draw, especially in junior high. I used to draw all sorts of crazy characters, mostly character inspired stuff. You know, I would have friends that were better two-dimensional artists than me, and we'd sit down and draw. And I remember just being so wrapped up in the look of the characters and what that said. It wasn't quite my medium for expression. And I think when I got into photography a little later in high school, that's when I found, and I did silkscreen a lot in high school too. And both of those like art forms really resonated with me. But I don't think it was until after college that I really found more of a passion in makeup and the arts that are involved in that.
So one of the things that you mentioned was that your dad was a sculptor. And did that play any influence later in life as you got into special effects makeup?
Yeah, I can honestly say, even though my father wasn't a sculptor for makeup, he sculpted a lot in clay and wax and wood and marble. And he was always pretty supportive of giving me the tools to kind of to whittle wood and, you know, made a lot of sharp sticks, a lot of knives and a lot of toy weapons. And you know, while he was making really like excellent sculpts, he would give me clay or whatever to play with. And I remember loving it and just loving what I could see him create. And I can honestly say he was probably my biggest influence, as far as sculpting. And then, you know, it wasn't until later when I found out, you know, the sculptors that he showed me artwork of in the movies. He introduced me to a lot of films and a lot of movies that I probably wouldn't have seen as a child without him saying, you know what, you should watch Enemy Mine. You know what, you need to watch Dragon Slayer.
Very cool.
And those artists, you know, ended up shaping me. I think I think it was a lot of makeup artists and maybe some of the sculptors, the early sculptors at Disney, as well as my father, that probably influenced me a lot.
So you said after high school, you went to College of the Canyons and you're in the radio, television, film program. What was that like at that time?
The RTVF program at COC when I was there was magic. It was It was really special. It was a really special time. We had a lot of really great instructors from all walks of life. We had cinematography instructors that taught at USC. We had a lot of CalArts master's grads running the program. So it was cool to have a different people from different walks of life throughout that entire department. And it was such a creative, nurturing, supportive building ground for art. Very collaborative. I instantly found a home there, and I was there forever, even when I wasn't going to school there anymore.
So when you went into the program, were you looking to be more like a director, writer, producer type thing? Or what was the path that you were looking at?
You know, at first I was like, all right, let's do this. Let's go to college. I wasn't big on just racking up tons and tons of debt until I kind of figured out what I wanted to do.
100%.
And the arts were always, I always knew I'd end up somewhere in the arts. I was performing professionally since I was 16. And it was a good way for me to kind of mix up a lot of my interests. When I was a child, I recorded radio shows back in the day. So cassette tapes. And, you know, I would play radio DJs and do skits with my sister, just really elaborate stuff. So I was always interested. I was a really serious rollerblader when I was a kid. I'd say almost professional rollerblader, even though that professional rollerblader barely even exists anymore. But I made a lot of skate films. So I made a lot of video skating, and we would end up kind of doing skits and hamming it up. But we had a video camera in our hands like 6 days a week.
So that's fantastic.
I think it was just a natural way to blend some of the photography skills I learned in high school with some of the performing and creative side that I had as a performer, and then find the actual tools and experience and facilities in order to make films. And I wanted to be a director. I was writing, directing, acting, and a lot of my own things, editing, doing sound design. You know, it was a great program. It was right when Final Cut Pro 2, I think, maybe was around, maybe 1.something, and Pro Tools LE. But for me, somebody who didn't grow up with my own computer until college, it was like amazing, you know, what you could do. And I had to learn basically computers just in order to backwards. I was learning Final Cut Pro and Pro Tools before I could type fast.
No, that's fantastic.
It was an environment.
As you mentioned, being a rollerblader or blader and creating those skate videos with your friends, was there any larger producers of skate videos or anything like that that played an influence on what you guys were creating?
You know, it was such a small niche. I got into rollerblading like aggressively before people even knew who that was. You know, people kind of just thought all rollerbladers were wearing spandex and weaving through cones, or if you were real crazy, or rolling down stairs backwards. And I found, I was staying with my friend and his dad one summer for a weekend in like Ventura Harbor. His dad lived on a boat, and there was a really cool liquor store there that had all kinds of weird magazines. And we were skating around and not knowing what we were doing until we found this magazine. It was called Daily Bread Magazine. And it was like one of the very first aggressive inline skating magazines. And that turned us on to videos. And we would just memorize everything and then be like, oh, who's that song? That song's so cool. We learned music. We went through the gamut of dressing crazy like our heroes did, wearing size 50 pants and knee pads and tight shirts. And then, you know, it all kind of calmed down. Yeah, as I got into high school, but it played a huge part of my life for a long time. It actually, as much trouble as I could have got in, as much trouble as we almost got in for skating sometimes right. when it wasn't. Yep. There weren't a lot of places. It was before there was a skate park in Santa Clarita. I was part of that movement to push, you know, go to city, you know, the city oh, council, cool. push for the first skate park. It really did keep me out of trouble. I never got into drugs. I never got into drinking or smoking or anything. I was just skating all the time. And yeah, it was actually really positive. It was a positive way of finding an outlet and not getting in trouble. And I had friends from all over the city, you know, friends that went to Canyon and Saugus, Valencia, friends in San Francisco and San Diego, and we'd go skate over there and they'd come up and it was a good time. It kept me out of a lot of trouble. And yeah, just having a video camera in my hand with a goal in mind was, I think, the beginning of kind of a dip into the future as far as, this is the medium that I can tell whatever form of artistic expression or performance. It's here. This does everything.
Right. You mentioned earlier that you worked at Six Flags. That's where I first met you in 2006, but I know you were there for a handful of years before. Was that, you said you started professionally performing at 16. Was it performing at Six Flags or what type of jobs were you doing there?
Yeah. When I was, 15 something, I don't know, maybe I was 16 at the time. There was a job fair at Hart High School.
And
I walked around and I was just like, nah. And then I saw this guy, this kind of chipper guy named David Ely. And he was there in his Six Flags blue supervisor uniform. Well, hey, come here. Let's talk about what we have to offer in entertainment. And I was like, this is cool. I was like, so you can get paid to dress like a character and entertain people. I was like, that sounds a lot more fun than some of the jobs I had done to that point. I started working really young, washing dogs sure. at an animal hospital. I worked at this hockey store that used to be in Santa Clarita called Hockey Stop.
I remember Hockey Stop.
Yeah. And so I had been kind of working, but when I turned 16, I got a job. I got the job at Six Flags. And I worked in the character department. And at the time, I don't know if it's still that way. I assume it is. But you know, if you're a character, you're also called a character foreman, which is like an escort for the characters.
Right. Exactly.
So I did both of those things. I was before I really got big, so I could play a lot of characters and it was a lot of fun being, embodying a character and making people believe that and making somebody's day special. And that led to doing parades and things at Six Flags. But the thing that always caught my eye at 16 is we'd be pushing our character barrels in through Gotham City.
Yep.
And right then, the monsters would start coming out from makeup and wardrobe. And you know what that's like.
Yes.
And it was, I've got, Foghorn Leghorn in a trash barrel. And I look over and these guys are creeping out of the Gotham City backlot gate. And I'm like, oh man, that's Bluebell the Clown. That's Jonathan the Vampire. That's Bone Daddy. That's Scusty. These are the hero. Like, I can't wait to turn 18 and audition for this. So my birthday's in September, luckily for me. So I was able to audition, I think, right before I turned 18, or maybe right after I turned 18, for Fright Fest in 1998. And that was a cool time. I remember just saying, I want to audition for every walk around character until I get something. I didn't want to be in a maze necessarily. I would have done it, but I was like, I'm out there. I play Batman in the parades. Maybe I can be a monster and wherever. And it was a cool time. I think it was different than when you came in. The audition process was really cool because it had, it had like Scott Ramp, who was in charge of her makeup and to this day still runs the makeup for Six Flags Magic Mountain Fright Fest. Ironically, I live in his old house. I live in Scott's old house. So for a long time, I was coming here to work on makeups and do demos. And he moved up to Canada actually for a while. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, hey, I was living in an industrial building and I needed to move out of there. And hey, what's going on with your house? And it ended up you know, I had to like find a place for a month, but now the old Scream Team shop is my shop.
And very cool.
It's special. And for them, it was hard to let this place go because they were here for 23 years, but they're happy once of me. Anyway, segue aside, you had Scott Ramp, who I thought was the coolest guy around for Fright Fest.
Yep.
He was like the godfather of Fright Fest. He was there at the audition table. You had like Scott Sterner, you had like Pam Bugbee, you had some like important people at a panel. And they would be like, all right, anybody interested in going out for the Gotham Gargoyle character, come forward.
Like, oh, cool.
Here we go. I'm going to go out for it. And they looked at me and they were like, yeah, you're great. But we think we can use you for something else. Just please come back and audition for another role. And I can say the gargoyle wasn't really my speed. I'm more of a speaking guy.
Yeah.
And so there was this character audition down, I think it was one of the next ones. They said, hey, we want to try something different. We want to have a gangster, a henchman, and a gun maul. Mm-hmm. Gun maul's like the gal with the fur coat, the big hair, and the old gangster.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And they said, we want to do something totally different that's been done before at a theme park Halloween event. We want to have you guys talk, and we want you to be kind of a comedy trio in Gotham City. And it was a really cool audition because I'm there and most people are older than me. And, you know, obviously since I was just turning 18, but I was there with like legit 40-year-old actors with credit. And this guy came to me and he was like, hey, let's partner up, but let's do it different. He's like, you're a lot bigger than me. So it'd be fun if you're the gangster and I'm the henchman. And I said, I love that.
Yeah.
And then they paired us with a gun maul character. And it was just kind of fire. From there, we just went up and I remember harassing the board. And he and I just clicked. His name was Scott. And I attacked the panel. And I was like, are you looking at my girl over here? And they're like, what? And then this guy jumped in. He goes, hey, boss, I think they're looking at your girl. And I was like, it looks like you're looking at my girl. I know you're not looking at my girl right now because that's going to upset me. And he goes, yeah, boss, I'm upset too. You know what you should do? You should break his leg. And I was like, hey, rats, you know what I want to do? I'm going to break his legs. He's like, yeah, boss, that's a good idea. I was like, yeah, glad I thought of that. And they were like, see. And they were, the poor gun mall was over here like, what just happened? So they ended up keeping me and Scott, and they they picked a different gun mall from a different group. As you know, Tom, from your experience at Fright Fest, Gotham City is pretty wild. Or now it's called something else, City Under Siege or something. To me, it's
City Under Siege is what they call it at Fright Fest, at least.
Yeah, so at the time, we learned quickly that comedy wasn't going to work out because it just made us the target. And we were limited in the things we could say, of course, because we're keeping things PG-13-ish, maybe a little lower. Mm-hmm. And people are not. So we learned we had to be really creative, and it became kind of almost, it's like insult comedy, kind of roasting rather than scaring. And it was a lot of fun. We found how to ride that line when you have kids in the park that are scared to death, and you have 25-year-old college football players that don't want to be scared in front of their friends, and you've got tough guys and people that throw punches because they're scared. We learned how to kind of find a line. And it was something that Six Flags was doing that no other park did, where we had talking monsters and full prosthetic makeup. And the next year it expanded, but that year I became, my character's name was Lucifer, a wordplay on the devil, of course.
Yeah.
Because I was thinking, if he's a gangster, he should be, what's his thing? Oh, he's kind of the devil in disguise or something, some version of it. Like, we had to kind of create our own Batman, Dick Tracy, nightmare kind of characters. Or they would give us something loose and give us a lot of creative freedom to go bring it to life. So the next year in 99, I did it, I did the same character, Lucifer, but I did it in full devil makeup, multiple horns, piercings through the prosthetic. I was very pierced up at the time. And so I kind of blur the line between what's real and what's not. And I remember, it escalated from there. I mean, in 1998, one thing that's kind of wild is one of my makeup artists, she wasn't my regular makeup artist, is now an Academy Award winner.
Makeup.
Yeah, her name is Robin Matthews. She won for Dallas Buyers Club. And she was one of Scott Ramp's main students at the Academy where he teaches.
That's
so
great.
It was pretty wild to go like, hey, Robin just won the Oscar. Good for you. Remember, remember 1998 when you were an actor and you were just dabbling with makeup, and now you have an Oscar and did some really exceptional work with a very small budget and without the ability to do a lot of prosthetic makeup, doing a lot of out of the camera stuff in addition to accentuate their own weight loss and personal changes that the actors went through to really sell that movie. So, yeah, it was cool. From there, things blew up. Scott asked me in 2000, he said, look, I want you to do the same thing you're doing in Gotham, but I want you to do it as my clown. And the Scream Team clown was kind of Scott's mascot for trade shows to sell the Scream Team. Before I did it, there was a gentleman, Dave Baker, who went by Bluebell, the clown.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And to me, he was the coolest character I'd ever seen. He was totally silent. He didn't talk at all. He was much smaller than me. He wore a yellow jumpsuit with blue hair, and he had like leather straps with cowbells, two to each arm and two to each leg. So if he walked, it sounded like somebody dropping a box of pots and pans down the stairs.
Oh, that's really cool.
But then he would stop and be really quiet and just wait for people to circle you. Because if you do that in Gotham, you have 1,000 people literally around you. And then music would start playing from nowhere and he would just start dancing. And just, I would watch this group of people go from being really brave to just like, nope, 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 nope. And then if he just rattle at somebody because of all his regalia, they would just fall over backwards. So when Scott asked me if I wanted to be a clown, I said, no, man. Yeah, I don't want to touch what Bell did. I don't want to touch it. It's too cool. I don't want to disrespect it. He's like, look, he's moved. He moved away to Maine. We had somebody else playing in clown last year. He got fired halfway through. He just wasn't good. He said, look, I want to do your makeup personally. We're going to sculpt a new piece for you. I'm going to make teeth. You're going to have contact lenses. You're my project. And I was like, well, Scott, I really love this devil character. It's a lot of fun. He goes, I want you to do the same thing, but do it like this. Just try it. And if you don't like it, I'll put you back in the devil. And I was like, fine. And from then on, it sort of exploded into a thing. And I ended up playing that character all around the world. Not all around the world, but not just in theme parks for 15 years.
Jeez, man.
Yeah, it was pretty special. It was a good time. It was a introduction. Fright Fest at Six Flags was really an introduction to special effects makeup for me. And I fell in love with it hard from the beginning. And it was not glamorous. It was not like a film set where you're clean back to one, where you look great, you have skin treatment on and go home glowing.
Sure.
Uh-huh. You remember, rip the prosthetic off quick with Super Solve. Good luck. Take the rest off with this works. I remember I used to use Dissolve It on my skin.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
a citrus like gum remover. And I would never dream of using Dissolve It on an actor. But you know, we did what we had to do. I had bleached my hair white when I was in my senior year at Hart, as I was this gangster character, and we would spray color my hair every day. Mm-hmm. So I would just go home, sit in the shower, just take the salt it.
Oh, so
and just
much.
Spray my whole head and my whole face and just rub it, and it would burn, and it would burn. I had keep my eyes closed. And then I'd be like, all right, wash it off, wash it off, wash it off. I got most of the glue, except for some stuff over here now. I think I have like burned skin, bleached hair with color in it, and like red all over my face from my senior pictures.
Oh my God,
dude. I don't care.
I so know how that went. No, when someone mentioned to me Super Solve, I went down to Friends. They're like, go to Friends, they'll have it, and just ask for the Super Solve stuff. So I got that pretty quick. And then people in the locker room afterwards were like, hey, you have your own bottle? I was like, yeah. They're like, let me have some. I was like, yeah, no.
$5 $5 a Dixie cup.
Yeah, exactly. $5 $5 for this little swab. Here you go.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. I mean, coming full circle, I fell in love with makeup. Scott was using far too good of makeup for a theme park.
Sure.
I mean, it was amazing. I think, you know, we crushed the makeup for haunts pretty much anywhere.
Correct.
Six Flags wasn't a big budget event. It wasn't known for that. It was, you know, very, very mom and pop, the way that the managers would get out and roll up their sleeves and put up flats. And
yeah.
So for years, I ended up doing kind of different things there. I wrote, directed, and starred in Halloween shows there as a clown. And then, we went and did Universal 1 year, and that was kind of a nightmare. Got to go to London to do trade shows. We hosted the Transworld Halloween Costume and Party Show in Rosemont, Illinois. We got to do some fun stuff, and it kind of opened up a world for me. I ended up getting enough of a reputation as being somebody who's good in makeup. And then I started doing a lot of demonstration makeups as an actor, as a model for people like Scott. Okay.
Yeah.
At trade shows, like the International Makeup Artist Trade Show in Los Angeles, down the street from me here in Pasadena.
Yeah.
And I was around all these amazing makeup artists, and I was doing demos for the company Premier Products Incorporated that makes Super Solve and makes the Telesis glue that Scott used to use at a theme park a million years ago. Like, we're talking extremely expensive silicone adhesive. And after several of these demos, I did one for Scott, I think, as a big devil. I'll have to send you some pictures so you can
on the stilts with the broken wings and the giant antlers and all that. Oh yeah, no, I've seen the pictures. No, that's one of my favorite looks that you guys have done.
Yeah, it's actually one of the coolest demos I've ever seen at a trade show, and it was really cool to be a part of it. Scott did a few devils on, you know, me and another gentleman, and they're pretty amazing. So anyway, I Scott was like, just tell him you like makeup. You know, tell him you're into it. Tell the people at PPI. And he ended up telling my other friend Scott, who's the owner of PPI, he's like, hey, you know, Dan's actually kind of into makeup. And Scott was like, really? Well, hey, whatever you want, because I had done a bunch of these trade shows. I was like, I don't know how much to ask for. I don't know how much is too much. He's like, here, come on. He grabbed a bag and just starts throwing, what kind of makeups do you want to do? And starts throwing palettes and Super Solve and different glues and different whatever in the bag. And, oh, hey, let's go over to Crown Brush. We'll get you some brushes. You know, get me brushes for free, all this stuff. So then I would kind of dabble. I would take old pieces from the Scream team, from Scott Ramp's company. Or pieces I even worn before at Fright Fest, wash them off, use them. And I started just doing self-application makeups for fun, just to use this stuff. And I would show them to Scott Ramp and Scott Heinle at PPI. And hey, just so you know, I'm so grateful for the product. I've been doing this stuff. And Scott Heinle from PPI said, wow, you did that? Yeah, I did that. You did that on yourself? Yeah. Like, well... do you think you could do that in front of people? And I said, yeah, I guess so. I'm not a makeup artist. But maybe I could do it as like the actor, haunter, cosplayer's perspective. Don't be scared of this professional makeup. It's just really good. It's not that scary. So he said, yeah, there's this new trade show, Monsterpalooza. And I think you'd be great at our booth doing a demo on yourself. I said, oh, cool. I could do something really simple. One zombie palette, a toothbrush, a paintbrush, and a sponge, and show people that they don't have to be scared of this professional makeup. So I did that, and I did kind of a zombie-ish character on myself, and that went well. And then I did one at the International Makeup Trade Show that was a little more full out. And then I started actually going to Scott Ramp and saying, hey, I want to make my own prosthetics for a demo. Can you help me? Yeah. Here, use this and this. I've already got your face, you know. And we, I started making my first foam latex prosthetics. And actually, the first full face prosthetic I ever made on myself, I put on myself in London at the International Makeup Artist Trade Show in London. And I kind of pushed myself each time. And people would start asking me, hey, this is amazing. You do this on yourself. Can you do this on other people? I'm like, yeah, it's a lot easier. It turns out it's a lot easier.
Right.
I'm a really good model. I'll put up with pretty much anything. You could almost put glass in my eyes and I'll just kind of take it because I understand the process. And I guess I have a high tolerance for makeup. But so I could do things to myself I would never do to an actor. Old school.
Yeah.
Things like gluing part of my eye open, you know, doing, you know, stuff that you know, goes way back to theatrical makeup with prosthetic makeups. So I ended up doing a ton of demos. And then people started to have some interest in me as a makeup artist. My friend did this low budget zombie movie. He said, hey, I really want you to work on this because I sold the look of the makeup on one of your zombies. And I said, cool. You know, I'm not a professional makeup artist, but maybe if I can make this really hard, low budget movie work. It was called April Apocalypse by the Tarmel Brothers. It's on iTunes. And we ended up doing like 100 and something zombies in 13 days with like four Jeez. People in a barn and in like Thousand Oaks on one of those film ranches. And we pulled it off. And I was like, all right, let's try it. So it's been kind of slowly building my career ever since April Apocalypse. I did one at COC where I was department head for makeup for a gentleman named Mike Ott. He did a feature film, which is like master's thesis at CalArts or something. And I did a port wine birthmark on the lead actor's face. So that had to be there every day. That was called, what's that called? Analog Days. Something like that. So it just became kind of a thing. And now my career has morphed into a bunch of little, it's going in the direction of more and more makeup, but right. I also get to play with the acting because I work for a lot of special effects shops that build amazing effects beyond what I build. And they send me to set with them. So I'll say, hey, Dan, open heart surgery, baby, born with his heart on the outside of his chest. They're going to do open heart surgery. We need you to go to Atlanta for the resident for like 3 or 4 days. Tech the baby, which means to take it, you know, do any modifications, any special effects I need to do, alterations, surgery processes, and puppeteer the baby, meaning I'm making its lungs breathe and its heartbeat, moving its arms. The first show I worked on like that was for a gentleman named Vincent Van Dyke. He was, in my opinion, the future of makeup in Los Angeles. He's a good friend of mine, and he's a phenomenal artist. I worked for him. I think my first day as a puppeteer was on How to Get Away with Murder with Viola Davis, who's an Academy Award-winning, incredible actress.
Yes. Yes.
In the Neo Intensive Care Unit of Providence St. Joe's, a real hospital, like on the floor under an incubator, making this baby work while this Academy Award-winning actor is having this incredibly dramatic moment. And her butt's like in my face. And I'm like, I can't believe this is real. You know?
You were talking about you were working on like a small independent type film where you were doing 120 zombies or so. In a short amount of time. Do you think that was like a turning point for you that all of a sudden like stuff started to click and you're like, hey, this is something I'm really enjoying? Because one of the things I haven't heard yet, it doesn't sound like you've gone to school for makeup. You're just learning by doing, right?
You said that pretty right on. It was a turning point. I said, this movie's hard. It's got almost no budget. The gentleman and I who were working together, we were having trouble. We were friends. We had done a lot of stuff together. He was another clown with me for years. And we butted heads on this movie. He just wasn't delivering. I don't want to throw him under the bus. He just wasn't really in the position to run that department on that show that was almost impossible. So I ended up coming in and kind of having to help run it. And I wasn't expecting that. I was going to come in and do makeup. But then I took on more and more responsibility. And I decided if I could make this movie work, we only had a few thousand dollars in our budget for everything. Mm-hmm. And we created processes to do it quick and fast. I stole bits and bobs from things I had just learned. There's a gentleman named Steve Laporte, who's an Oscar winner, multiple Emmy winner, and he's a BAFTA winner. He's a good friend of mine. He was one of the original artists on Beetlejuice.
Very cool.
Just amazing amounts of stuff. And I used to live near him, and he was really generous at this time. He'd be like, "Hey, Dan, you know, what are you doing? Hey, come over. We're doing something. You might like to learn it." And I watched him do these little, what were brand new at the time, these things called prosade transfers, which are, it's a type of thickened makeup adhesive that's actually made into prosthetic that's extremely rugged. And he was running them out of these little clear molds from silicone. I said, "Hey, this is what we need to do the zombies, quick and easy. Nose bridges, cheekbones, and wounds that we can just take them out of these molds, throw some telesis on, smack them on, blend them off, quick, they're bulletproof." So it was like I learned this right in time for this movie. And being able to pull off that film was kind of where I said, "Hey, if I can do this, I should go for it. If I fail miserably, I'm going to go out. I'm going to have to kill me to get me to fail." And I think it was actually pretty successful. I learned a ton. I didn't go to school for makeup. I had a lot of background in different art for fun. I had taken art in school. I had taken photography. I had sculpted for fun. It wasn't something I went to school for. I was lucky enough to have modeled for a lot of great artists and to be able to ask them things, you know, be like, "Hey, can I come over and watch? Can I help you? Can I clean your shop and see what you're doing?" Or for some reason, I retain things that are done to me. Like when I go to the dentist, I go, "Okay, I know what you're doing. You're going to change that and you're going to clamp this and you're going to hit it with the UV light." And they're always like, "Yeah." Why I can retain it helps when there's a makeup mirror in front of you. You've got nothing to do for hours. So we sit there "Well, he's using that white stuff on the edge to kind of blend it off. Okay. So I just practiced and I made a lot of mistakes. And my friend Mike Spatola has a series of books called The Monstrous Makeup Manual. If you're into makeup or if you think you might be, I think this is the best expense you could probably make right in the beginning. There's three books. They're paperback and they're also digital. And there's hundreds and hundreds of super high res images in the digital version. So I would keep Monstrous Makeup Manual 1 on my iPhone and I could go to like friends, beauty supplier Nigel or MPFX or whatever, and go, "Do you have Epoxy Parfilm 4? And they'll be like, "Yeah, right over here."
Oh, that's fantastic.
You know? Or I could ask Mike and say, "Hey, what's the difference between Epoxy Parfilm 3 and Epoxy Parfilm 4? These are just releases for molds.
Sure.
And so I would go home and make mistakes. And, you know, I was working a lot and I would take a lot of my money and do little, you know, take some of it, buy materials or experiment. And then I started getting little projects and I started struggling my way through figuring it out. You know, I remember some things I built, I'm like, "Oh man, that was a giant fail. Of course it was." Yeah. But I think you learn more from the having to make things work and make mistakes. I don't knock makeup school. I work for Cinema Makeup School and for Makeup Designery in Burbank in different respects. I was a substitute teacher at Cinema Makeup School for a while, a few years back. They have a good program. I think a lot of people benefit from the structure and a lot of people need to have. It was like College of the Canyons film program for me. That idea, like, you're in this environment of facilitating creativity and you have the tools and the knowledge. And I think I translated my motivation from the COC days into learning my craft. I think, you know, people ask me all the time, what do you think about makeup school? And I'm like, you know what? It's expensive. It mm-hmm. takes up some time. If you use it to the fullest, it's a great expense. If you don't, sure. if you're just going to, because your parents are paying, you're probably not going to fight hard. And it's a tough industry. This industry is yeah. brutal. I've been at it for about 8 years professionally, and I'm still working on getting into the makeup union. I've been a union actor for a long time. The makeup union is it's really challenging and it's really exclusive. Mainly, I think, because there's not that much work. And it's like broadcasting, you know, where people who go to school for broadcasting are so talented and so motivated, but there's not a lot more jobs coming out.
Right.
The industry is morphing. It's changing.
Sure.
You might be on to ride that curve. But to say like, oh, I want to be on Channel 4 News as a weathercaster, be like, well, somebody has to die first.
You know? Right.
So makeup's a little bit that way, and I don't blame them because they're protective of the work and they want to make sure it's kept high quality and the rates are kept high. And I'm a firm believer in unions, so it's been a little slower for me, honestly, to get in because I won't undercut the union.
That's nice.
I don't take jobs that just devalue what we're doing. So many people I know have had to scrimp and fight their way to get into the union by doing jobs for $100 a day.
Yeah.
You know, which is like less than minimum wage.
Right.
Just to get their days. Because it takes 180 days of non-union shows in three consecutive years, so 60, wow. 60, 60, to get into the union, or wow. 30 on a union show. But the only way to do that, really, is if that show flips from a non-union okay. show that you started on and becomes okay. a union show. Then gotcha. The union will say, hey, you're welcome to pay your way in and join the union. And they're pretty exclusive. And there's an East Coast union and a West Coast union. And they talk and I think it's decently easy to transfer from one to the other, but when you're on the outside, it's tough. So that's been a slow process. I've got some hope, you know, if the world opens yeah. up, I've got a project that looks really promising yeah. for me. And the union has signed off on having me be a special skills waiver, meaning I can work for this movie, this union, as a non-union person, and those days will count retroactively.
That's good.
I've been developing since the beginning a new cool. process for this.
So one of the things that I know about you, and I've used your product before, but can you tell me a little bit about Mouth Effects, how that came about? Because it's a really cool product. Just tell us a little about what it is, how it works, and how you came about creating it.
Sure. Even in 1998, when I did Fright Fest, I had this beautiful makeup, you know, full face prosthetics. My hair was colored, costume was on point, but I would look at myself and I go, you know, I'm yellow. My face is yellow. My hair is green, but why is my mouth pink and fleshy and healthy and human looking? So what I was like, it has to be somewhere around this. And at the time there really wasn't, and it was, your choices were food coloring. So I would just take food coloring, put it in my mouth and swish it around and taste like death. It's not really good for you.
Yeah.
So throughout the years, I kept that idea in my mind for my demos. Like, there has to be, you know, I learned how to make, you know, dental acrylic teeth and do things like that.
Okay.
Still, even with dental plates, unless they're over the lip dental plates, like you see a lot in Walking Dead that have gums up over your lips, you're going to see the gums, you're going to see the tongue, you're going to see the soft palate, you're going to see the soft parts of the mouth, and they just don't look right. And even if you wear teeth, they don't blend it to the soft parts. You know, your gums might be purple and infected and gross, but then your tongue is pink and fleshy and happy. So I started trying to come up with something safe and more professional to use to color the mouth. There were really good products to color your teeth. There are generic teeth out there. You know, people have been making and casting teeth for almost 100 years, and maybe more, with dentures. But I started experimenting and I noticed different people and different characters. And I go, hey, how'd you get your mouth like that? What are you doing? Yeah, food coloring, huh? Okay. And then I came up with something, and I part of it was a bit of some I took my friend Mike Spatola, who makes the Montrose Makeup Manual. Mm-hmm. He was using something a little different. And I was like, oh, okay, there's other ways to do this. And but I wanted to make it safer, more. I wanted to do something that was actually tested for safety, actually tested for microbes. So I kind of took some ideas and I did my own research. Okay, what's in this stuff that everybody's using? What's safe? What's not safe? And I just started making a product myself for my stuff. I did it on April Apocalypse. It was one way to quickly turn a bunch of people into zombies just by having them leak gross fluid and, you know, spit coming out of their mouth with a little bit of alcohol-based makeup zombies. So I was doing it on April Apocalypse. It wasn't until my friend Chris was working on Fear the Walking Dead. And I had given some samplers out to people before, different artists from the United States, Canada, and the UK. My friend Mark Coulier, he's a massive makeup artist in the UK. He's got like 2 Oscars, maybe 3. Iron Lady. Wow. Trying to remember. He just did this Pinocchio movie where the makeups are insane. Anyway, he's a phenomenal artist. I gave him a kit and he was like, hey, I use this all the time, but I don't use it on the teeth. I use it just on my lips. It's on the gum.
Oh, okay. Right. Yeah.
So people were doing it at different things. And I was just like, well, what does everybody think? And I had my friends at Premier Products kind of were like, hey, let's help you. You know, whatever we can do to help you with this, we can check the microbes. We can do extended shelf life tests. We have full-time cosmetic chemists because they're FDA licensed. They're one of the only special effects makeup companies that is. And some are certified, some are approved, mostly not. They're fully licensed because they started in toupee and medical adhesive and hospital soaps and really intense stuff. So they're like, hey, what do you want to do with this? So, well, I'm not sure. My friend Chris came to me and he said, hey, can I get a bunch of that? He was calling it mouth stain. Everybody wants to call it mouth stain. I try not to use the word stain because it doesn't stain. It doesn't stain anything in your mouth. Dental acrylics, it doesn't matter. Some of the old tooth enamels do. So that was like why people are a little weird about that. He said he's working on Fear the Walking Dead, and I think they were filming in Mexico at the time. And he said the actors won't wear the KMB stuff. I said, well, what are they using? Is that mouthwash and food coloring? I'm like, of course they're not. They're not going to want to wear that. It doesn't work good. It tastes bad. It makes you feel bad. Yep. Like, I can't swallow it. So can I get a bunch of your stuff? I'm like, oh, man, I don't know what the legality is to sell it. I'll give you some. Test it for me. And he said, I want to buy it. I want to buy it. I said, no. Test it for me. And he tested it. He goes, they love it. All the artists want to buy it. You should do something with this. And after that, you know, the microbe tests were clean. The shelf life tests were good. After a while, I started selling it a little bit myself. I'd have a small presence on the online store or selling directly to artists. But after a while, I realized I was going to take up a lot of my time. So the folks at Premier Products were actually pretty interested in the product. They make Skin Illustrator, they make Vitalysis, and they're the best company in special effects makeup. They're like, what do you want to do? And at first I was thinking, maybe I'll have you manufacture it. So they manufactured it for a little while and I distributed it. And then later we worked out a deal. So they manufacture and distribute it. I'd quality check it and I basically receive the royalty every month. And if I die, you know, my family will get that money.
That's really
cool. It's not much. It's inexpensive. It's a niche product. Sure. We're hoping once the world opens up, probably next year, we'll try to be in the Halloween market. Cause I think that's an easy product to use.
Yep. So one of the questions I have, you know, obviously you're doing the special effects stuff. You're getting more and more gigs, 10, 15 years down the road. You know, what's the dream job? What do you want to be doing? Where do you see yourself?
It's a good question. I think eventually I'd like to revisit directing again.
Cool.
Creating some of my own content. I have some really talented people around me in the stunt world, acting world, camera world. It'd be really cool. Kind of, I think, someone who's really set the career bar high is Greg Nicotero from KMB Effects. If you don't know who he is, Walking Dead, Narnia, he's one of two now owners of one of the most massive special effects makeup companies in the world. Him, Howard Berger, and Robert Kurtzman started it. That's why it's KNB, Kurtzman, Nicotero, and Berger. Now it's nice. Nicotero and Berger. If you know anything about Greg's career, he got in on Walking Dead really early as a producer. I think they came to him and said, hey, we want KNB to do this. And he said, well, you can't afford us, but get us in on the ground floor as a producer. And now he's executive producer. He's a director. He's a writer. KNB does all the effects for Fear the Walking Dead. And he's got a, you know, that's a little lofty, you know, but if you're going to set the bar high, it would be cool. Sure. Not necessarily do things on that scale, but I'd really like to get back to telling stories and creating content and creating film. But I never liked the business. I never liked the hustle of Hollywood personally. And I think it sort of helps to have some clout, some sort of in somewhere. So people take you a little more seriously. But you know what? I don't know, Tom. I don't know where my life is going to end up. I'd love to be on set more. I really catch the bug when I'm performing, and it actually does account for a large amount of my income being on set. Just my days, my SAG-AFTRA days on set are good. That's where I get my benefits. I also perform in the Waterworld stunt show at Universal Studios. Done that for 10 years. Before that, I did all sorts of other things at Universal Studios Hollywood. I was a New York cop. I was the puppeteer of the donkey puppet. I was the warm-up guy for Fear Factor Live. I was Beetlejuice for 10 years. I was a stilt walker. I'd done Grinchmas, the tree lighting show. I've done Halloween shows there. I've done a lot. So I've learned a little bit. I've done a lot of special events all over the world. Like, I've worked Comic-Con a few times for Walking Dead. I've worked for Walking Dead and Hyundai a few times, creating zombies for events. Worked for Rob Zombie's Dawn of the Con. Many, many trade shows for makeup. So all I know is, if I'm doing something in this world and I'm paying my bills, I'm going to be really happy. And I think diversification has been great for me up until now. Yeah. When I go, okay, I've got 4 days a week if I want them at Waterworld. I've got, you know, a decent amount of SAG after jobs. I've got more and more makeup jobs. Mouth effects is in pretty much the industry standard for mouth makeup now. You know, it's been on Star Wars, Star Trek, American Horror Story, Vikings, Game of Thrones. It's on everything. And that's really cool to me and really special that someone like me who's so new to the industry, still trying to break in, has created something that has changed makeup a little bit. Mm-hmm. And I may not be at the level of some of these artists, but my product is in their kit. And it's been helpful for me. People are like, oh, you're the mouth effects guy. So that's good. I think I'll be a 706 artist. I think I'll be union in makeup in 15 years, hopefully less than that. I think I'll still be performing. One thing that I've fallen back in love with is character acting, creature acting. And, you know, I have friends that run these great shows. I play a character called Lieutenant Unk on the Orville now. I wasn't the original Lieutenant Unk from season one. It was only in one episode. And I don't know now what's going to happen after the world opens up, if I'll still be playing Unk. But, you know, I got to get into a big 100-pound creature suit, you know, being directed by Seth MacFarlane. You know, which is so surreal when you can't see and all you hear is, wait, who do we have here? Hey, Dan, let's take that again, but let's, a little less on the truck. I see what you're doing, but just bring it down a little bit. You know, I'm like, okay, Brian, the dog.
Oh, man. If you could give advice to your younger self or to the next generation about the arts, what would it be and why?
If I had to go back and give myself advice, or if I do give advice to the younger generation, for whatever reason, maybe because I'm not that far ahead of them, I get a lot of questions, and that I do photography for makeup designer, I get this question a lot. I think it's to start making mistakes, to just get in there and be prolific. I think for any craftsman or any artist, you have to practice your art. And I think the more art you do on your own, for a while I was trying to do a makeup a week, the better you're going to get. More people are going to respect, even if they're not all, you'll get some haters. There are people in makeup that are like, only want to see the most amazing makeup ever. But I think other artists go, wow, that guy's doing makeup. He's passionate. He's learning. Okay, he's pushing himself outside his comfort zone. So I think it's do it a lot. Believe in it. Know that it's going to be a brutally hard struggle. Know that it's nothing in entertainment for most people comes easy. For some people, you always hear about that. But it's always a challenge. It's always competitive. So if it's something you really want to do, know you really have to compete with other people. And you're kind of in, you can't control what they do, but you can control what you do. So start putting that work in. Believe in yourself. I'm grateful that I had a varied education. It comes in handy all the time, that I can look at the camera and ask the, you know, second AC, hey, what kind of glass do you have? And they'll be like, oh, it's a 35. And then I'll go, okay, it's a 35 prime. I know we got about this much room. I know what kind of depth of field we have. I know, you know, let's see what we're shooting on an Alexa. Okay, I know that this is going to handle this light differently. So these things have helped me. Having a little bit of knowledge and a little respect for different career paths is good. I think whatever it is, you need to push yourself. You need to learn. You need to learn the areas around your career and your jobs just enough to respect them and show them. So I think that's probably the advice. I don't know. I've worked on a lot more things than I ever would have imagined in different capacities, and super low budget to super high budget. And I definitely want to see myself grow and progress into that world of the higher budget things. They're just, the possibilities are kind of limitless, and the amount of talent and professionalism that are really around you, along with a lot of salty, grumpy people who are used to it. But I'm not yet. You know, I'm so excited when I get to play on these shows, and I've been so grateful for all of the support I've had from people throughout the industry.
That's great, man. And, you know, I think that's the perfect place. No, it's all good. No, I think, you know, that's a perfect thing, because like I've said, I've watched you since the Fright Fest days, and seeing where you're going now, man, is such an inspiration to me, and just watching how your career has blossomed, and I'm excited to see where you go. And I really appreciate you taking time out to talk with us, and we'll be back with a second episode talking to you about your performer days, man. So thanks very much, man. I appreciate it.
Rock and roll. Thank you, Tom.
Thanks for joining me here at the Newhall Family Theater. Until next time, I'm your host, Tom Lund. I'll see you backstage.